Initiate countdown.
8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Warning.
She's alive! Alive!
Warning.
Puny man matches his cunning against a monster from Mars running rampant.
Warning.
Dead or alive, you are coming with me.
Warning.
You gotta tell him! Silent Breed is people!
Warning.
Hello, pretty, pretty.
Warning.
Welcome to the Martian Drive-In Podcast.
With your host, Terry Frost.
The Martian Drive-In Podcast is a four-weekly podcast of speculative fiction movie appreciation. Each 4 weeks, Terry and his guests will pick two movies and strip them to the bone. They can be new, old, or in between science fiction, fantasy, or horror. What they have in common is that they aren't the big blockbusters that everyone knows about. Martian Drive-In looks for the interesting films that might not be on your radar, but that might just be worth your attention and appreciation. Go to marsdrivein.blogspot.com. Feedback is always welcome via email at cultguru@gmail.com. That's K-U-L-T-G-U-R-U @gmail.com. Or you can leave a voicemail at area code 206-2033-299. Enjoy!
Welcome to the Martian Drive-In Podcast number 4. My name's Terry Frost and I have guests. I'm actually in the same room as them this time.
Amazing.
Introduce yourselves, guests.
Hi.
Bingo.
I'm gesturing for you to. It's a non-radio.
That's his
signal.
Name. I'm Sonia Marcon. Hello, gesturing to you.
Hi, my name's Grant Watson. We both do the Bad Film Diaries podcast, not as often as we should.
Nobody ever podcasts as often as they'd like.
No. Yeah, but we haven't podcasted in like 4 months. It's a bit embarrassing.
Well, yeah, but on the other hand, real life intervenes sometimes.
Yeah.
It always does. So, yeah, we're going to do a couple of movies. There's a surprise. We're going to do a couple
really?
Of movies. We're doing Cypher from 2002, director by Vincenzo Natali. And we are doing a kind of interesting, though we're going to disagree in which way interesting, movie from 2007 called The Man from Earth, also known as Jerome Bixby's Man from Earth. So how are you guys, and what have you been watching that's good, shit, or indifferent?
One thing really interesting that we have actually watched recently is Newsies.
That's a Broadway musical. I saw it on the Tony Awards.
Before it was a Broadway musical, it was a 1992 Disney feature film starring Christian Bale and Robert Duvall. Christian Bale sings, Duvall doesn't. I was a bit disappointed.
Yeah, so was I.
Yeah, I mean, he could have been the new Lee Marvin singing Wandering Star.
I know, there was so much potential. But it's basically about a, you know, 1890s newsboy strike in the US and has songs composed by Alan Menken, who at that point was riding very high off the sort of Renaissance Disney films like
Little Mermaid.
Yeah, Little Mermaid. Yeah,
the music in Newsies was, the music in Newsies was amazing.
Yeah, I saw that on the Tony Awards, they did the dance numbers.
Yeah.
And I've never seen so many guys in short pants jumping over each other. It was just impressive.
So it was a disastrous flop when it came out. It made something like $2 million worldwide.
That's so unfortunate.
Yeah. And as far as I'm aware, it's never been released in Australia, so we bought the new Blu-ray from the US.
As you do.
Mm. And yeah, it's surprisingly good. It's not. It's one of those films I can see why it wasn't a success, but I can also see why it has a massive cult following in the US.
And that's the thing. I couldn't see why it wasn't a success.
Well, for one thing, Christian Bale can't really sing or dance.
I could probably speculate on why it wasn't a success. At that time, Disney didn't get onto the bandwagon of how to do new media or how to do promotions very well.
Yeah.
And sometimes old studios like Disney, which get a bit fossilized, and when they get something that's new and a bit different, they don't know what to do with it, even though they agreed to make it and they did everything on the production. When it comes to promoting it, they're just looking at each other and going, what the fuck?
Mm. Well, they famously had that problem in the late 70s after Star Wars. They had no comprehension of what they were supposed to be making anymore.
So they made The Black Hole.
Yeah.
Yeah, which I saw it at the time with a bunch of fans. And, I've never seen so many people rush for the toilets.
It freaked me out as a child. It's a really... That whole string of... I mean, Sonia and I, you and I are both big fans of that weird string of Disney movies with that and Dragon Slayer,
Return
something...
Return to Oz.
Yeah, Return to Oz, something Wicked
Return
This Way
Return to
comes.
Oz are kind of like.
Oh, that's a fantastic film.
And they're all weirdly inappropriate and dark.
Yep.
Yeah, Something Wicked This Way Comes.
That's an absolutely fantastic
one. Yeah, that one's one of the quality ones they did.
Yep.
And they really kind of decided to do something that grown-ups could find approachable. And one of the problems is having so many birthdays. You get to a certain stage of Disney movies and it's not for you.
Yeah.
And when they came out, they weren't for me. It's like Star Wars. It's probably one of the problems over Star Wars. I was in my late teens, early 20s when Star Wars came, something like that. Yeah. 20 I was. And I could see all of the books that they pinched from.
Yeah.
Because I was deeply into reading science fiction novels at the time.
See, at that point, yeah. I hadn't read any of the books that it was based on and was buying all the toys instead.
And I went, what the fuck? This guy is a ripoff merchant. Which, of course, history has proved me right.
Mm.
But some people drank the Kool-Aid when they were too young not to drink the Kool-Aid.
In his defense, I don't think Lucas has ever claimed he's not a ripoff merchant. He's often been quite open about his sources, and yes, I was inspired by this, I was inspired by that.
Oh, inspired meaning ripping off, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I was going to say, inspired is a bit of a different word. Yeah.
Yeah, I was talking, last podcast, I was talking about, which one was it? Oh, yeah, Idiocracy we did.
Mm-hmm.
And we're talking about how it ripped off The Marching Morons by C.M. Kornbluth wholesale. The whole plot, every bit of it except the ending.
Yeah.
Is ripped off straight from Kornbluth's short story, which I picked up on the Kindle.
I've actually seen Idiocracy. Mm. So is their ending better than the Kornbluth?
I like the Kornbluth ending because the protagonist in the Kornbluth is a total asshole and has his comeuppance. But in Idiocracy, just to make the plot work in a comedy, they make him the exact average guy in the US Army.
Oh, okay.
So he's not too bright, but he's not dumb. But compared to everybody else, he's very bright because he goes into the future where it's full of morons. But that was a lot last podcast.
Mm.
But yeah, there's so many rip-offs of things. And the more you know about science fiction, the more you kind of get disheartened that people aren't doing something new and are kind of taking bodies out and doing the Frankenstein thing, and I'm taking little bits and pieces from here and there and trying to put together and bang electricity through them.
Yeah, and there's that thing, I think, with science fiction film where they always seem to be running about 20 to 30 years behind science fiction literature.
Mm.
Absolutely, though. They do seem to be getting on the front foot with steampunk.
Yeah, I'm so not interested.
I haven't seen Sucker Punch yet. I've got it recorded on my Foxtel, but again, it's a bit like Prometheus. We were talking about Prometheus earlier. I'm a bit reluctant to see it because I've got other things I want to spend the time on.
Yeah. Sucker Punch. I've seen Sucker Punch. I think you were away. I can't remember where you were. You were on holiday somewhere or something. Sonia.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't remember watching it, but that's nothing to take seriously. I don't remember a lot.
It's got a really nice soundtrack, is one thing I'll say in favour. Like, I bought the soundtrack, really like that. But it's kind of like someone tried to... Zack Snyder, I think, the director.
One. No, I haven't seen that
yeah,
one.
Yeah, it's like he tried to remake Moulin Rouge with more kung fu.
Yeah.
I didn't even like Moulin Rouge. I liked the original one that José Ferrer was in 1952. But the recent one, one of the big problems I had with that one was they picked every fucking obvious song they could to put into that Moulin Rouge, and you went, oh shit, and they weren't very good to start with.
I think that was kind of deliberate though, for what he was trying
to make. They're trying to bore the audience.
No, like he's trying to make a popular musical for a new generation.
I mean, Baz Luhrmann's a hard person to get a tag on. They did Australia, and the bits they showed of Darwin didn't look a hell of a lot like Darwin.
No.
And Nicole Kidman is fascinating because she's kind of like a Star Trek The Next Generation alien. She's got that weird appliance on her forehead, and she doesn't look quite like a human being.
You like Nicole Kidman, don't you?
Oh, yeah, she's fan-friggin-tastic.
Oh, sarcasm. Hang on, let me turn up the sarcasm on the mixer.
Oh. The best thing I've ever seen Nicole Kidman in was BMX Bandits.
No, Wave Rider, she showed her tits in it.
Oh, well, there you go.
I just like, ever since like the Botox and the skin peel, chemical peel set in, she just does just look constantly surprised in every movie.
Apparently she did something with Clive Owen about Hemingway and one of his chicks. And the review that I saw, it might have been in Slate or Salon on one of those websites, was purely about Nicole Kidman's forehead.
It's because it's hypnotising. You wind up staring at it and she's got weirdly pointy eyebrows.
Have you ever seen someone with Botox up close?
Never.
It's eerie because they have this sheen to the skin of the forehead that really puts you off. And if you're talking to them, and I've done this about three times.
Do you have to wear sunglasses?
No. You always make sure you do it at night when the lights are fairly dim.
Oh.
But
they got 3-point back.
You can't not look. It's like women with breast implants who wear low cut tops.
Oh, all right.
Yeah, you want to see where the bag's showing. There. You want to see where the bag's showing on the top of the cleavage. Yeah. It's a bit like that. And
want to get your drumsticks out and just have a go on them.
And then, in the conversations with the Botox people, there are certain things you look at. I'm talking to you now, and I can see all sorts of facial expressions, right?
I can't help it.
Which is great. I love it. Okay. But with those people, you're not getting those cues back on the conversation. And it's like you're hearing somebody bent down a very bad phone line.
Mm.
And we're going to waffle like this, but I don't care. I'm going to do a long podcast if I have to. So basically Botox, I think, apparently there's a new thing now too where if people stop it, all their skin sags and they start looking like they're a half-melted candle.
Yeah.
Awesome. I find that with but just actors in Hollywood who have plastic surgery at a particular point in their careers and then 20 years later, the plastic surgery. I mean, Mickey Rourke's the obvious example. Mm. He's quite open about...
Burt Reynolds.
Yeah.
Mm.
Melanie Griffith, who's not really in anything anymore, if you ever see photos of her. No. She's...
What's her face, who's not an actor? She doesn't actually do anything. She's just rich and she's had lots of work done. She's got a great big picture of herself.
It's definitely not Gina Reinhart.
No. She looks like shit. What's her bloody name?
Paris Hilton.
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Even her porn movie looked scary because... I'm used to 1970s porn where women have some form of body hair somewhere.
Oh, yeah.
And Paris Hilton's one was like...
hairless,
they really didn't like each other. It was almost like they were doing a tag team wrestling match with their genitals.
Did they do that rub-rub slap thing? Because I find that really, really humorous.
Which particular rub-rub slap thing? There's a lot of it goes on.
When they're doing it and there's just the whole, like, rub-rub-rub.
Oh, okay, yeah. You guys can't see that, but I know what you mean.
Yeah.
It's probably
we drifted off science.
All you can hear is the slapping bit, and that's all you need to hear.
Yeah, if anybody wants to see it, grab one of the three of us at a convention, or we'll put up a YouTube video of Sonya doing that or something.
Yeah. The noughties porn, the rub-rub slap move.
Yeah. But, my theory on women is, particularly in regard to porn, is women should be biodegradable.
I like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You shouldn't just leave bags of shit lying around when you rot.
Yeah, you get a coffin full of bones and bumps.
Yeah, bones and little bags of wobbly stuff.
Exactly.
Now I've just got this image in my head of Nicole Kidman in a coffin with just like a skeleton except for a fleshy forehead that's like completely smooth.
And a pair of eyebrows.
Yeah, looks
that's
surprised.
The other theory you could do about her is there's actually no flesh there. They've just like flesh-toned her skull.
Yeah, totally.
The flesh turned off.
Well, and she's had so many skin peels to get rid of her freckles that she's now apparently quite see-through.
I like a couple of freckles on a woman sometimes. It's kind of cute.
She's just a weird actor. Because I don't think she's a bad actor, but I don't think by any stretch she's an exceptionally good actor. Yeah. I don't understand why she can.
And then we've got
to
the Tom Cruise thing where he divorces his wives when they turn 33 as some kind of secret Scientology ritual to make Xenu come back or something.
Oh, is that why he's divorced Katie Holmes?
I thought he just liked having divorces.
She actually set up an apartment in secret across town in New York. She picked the cooler side of New York that I know. The day before she left him, she was out buying bottles of olive oil and other things for the kitchen. And then suddenly, bam, out the door and serving the papers. While he was in Iceland doing a shit movie. Yeah.
Yeah, I heard he was out of the country when she served.
He was in Reykjavik or something. They're doing a science fiction movie where undoubtedly he will run very fast. Which he does in every.
I think that's a Hollywood.
The only one he didn't do was Born on the 4th of July. After a while, he stopped running in that movie for some reason.
Yeah, that's what happens when that happens.
But
to you. On
to science fiction.
Shit, I lost my legs.
After we've just destroyed Hollywood for, 12 minutes now, we're going to take a break. And when we get back, we're actually going to talk about the movies.
And we'll destroy them for you.
Oh.
Well, no.
Let's be a little kinder than we were on Nicole Kim. Okay.
Come and take a trip in my rocket ship. We'll have a lovely afternoon. Kiss the world goodbye and away we fly. Destination moon. Travel fast as light till we're lost from sight. The earth is like a toy balloon. What a thrill you get riding on a jet. Destination moon. We'll go up, 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 up. Straight to the moon we two. High in the starry blue, I'll be out of this world with you.
So away we steal in a spacemobile, a supersonic honeymoon. Leave your cares below, pull the switch, let's go. Destination Moon.
And we're back again, and I still have guests, Grant and Sonia, and we're going to talk about
I'm sorry.
Don't apologise. You're the first chick I'm not married to that's been on the podcast.
You're special.
And I hope you're not the last. But anyway, so Cypher from 2002, and I've lumbered Grant into doing a kind of synopsis. It's a very hard movie to synopsize.
I'll do my best.
Go ahead.
I'm going to crib from the Wikipedia page that Terry has very nicely printed out for me. Film stars Jeremy Northam as Morgan Sullivan, who's a recently unemployed accountant, very bored with his suburban life. And while he's being pressured by his wife to take a job with her father's company, and the kind of the safe thing, he instead decides to pursue a career in corporate espionage. So he goes to work for a company called DigiCorp. He's given a new identity, Jack Thursby, and he's sent to a series of business conventions to secretly record presentations and transmit them back to the headquarters. He starts doing this a couple of times, and he starts beginning to suffer hallucinations, headaches, and that's the point where he meets up with a woman, Rita Foster, played by Lucy Liu, who appears to be from a competing corporation. And as it says here, his life starts to become complicated, which I think is possibly the best synopsis.
Yeah, it's a bit of an understatement there, isn't it? Yeah, so...
not how I would have said it.
Directed by Vincenzo Natali, who did Splice. People might remember that from a couple of years ago.
Also Cube.
He did Cube, yep. And he's done one, the Black Death, recently too, which is set in medieval times.
Okay.
Wow.
Which I have a copy of, which I acquired by some mysterious means because I never left my chair. And I am going to watch it because I do like Natali's stuff, and I think he's got a good hook on science fiction.
He really does.
Mm. Yeah. And, so Jeremy Northam's an interesting choice for the main protagonist because he's playing an American and he's an English actor.
He's playing it in a very mannered way is one of the things I noticed. It's a lot of the performances in the film feel deliberately sort of 1950s America.
That's for plot reasons as well because nobody is quite what they seem.
Mm.
And a lot of the people you see aren't the people, they're the facade that people have. So I think that was a kind of deliberate device that they used.
Are you a spy?
No.
You will have to deceive other people about what you do for a living. Even your own wife. You don't mind lying to your wife?
No.
So what do you do besides travel to dull cities and talk to women in hotel bars?
Play golf.
You're lying when you say that your name is Jack Thursby. You're lying when you say that you are not an undercover agent. You are lying when you say that you do not work for DigiCorp. And I cannot tell you how happy that makes us. You will be our next courier. And DigiCorp will think they have hit the mother lode. If you behave like Morgan Sullivan instead of Jack Thursby, they will eliminate you.
If you want answers, take the shot.
You're just Nazis. You used me. Dylan Rooks.
Sebastian Rooks is not the person you think he is.
Morgan Sullivan ultimately proves to be a very interesting person indeed.
Mm.
Mm.
And it's got this kind of semi-futuristic thing. It's like, you know, 5 minutes in the future, Max Headroom kind of future.
Yeah.
To it where they have groovy little black helicopters, which, though the CGI isn't too good on them, are kind of a nice...
It's forgivable, though, I think, given the...
That's what makes the film awesome, I think.
What, the slightly unbelievable?
Yeah. I really, really get into kind of dodgy CG because it makes it feel like that I'm not watching a computer game.
Yeah. Sel does that. She likes the Asylum films and all those really bad monster movies.
Transmorphers and...
Yeah, all of those.
Dino Croc versus Super Crocodile.
What did I get recently? Arachnoquake. Which is basically a whole bunch of giant spiders come up through the Louisiana swamps and start eating New Orleans.
Oh, so it is as good as it sounds.
It is, and it's got like people who used to be on science fiction TV shows 15 years ago.
Oh, brilliant.
I noticed that Debbie Gibson and Tiffany, the pop stars, now have a whole new career starring in these movies.
Yeah.
But I think as opposed to those kind of films, Cypher really takes the genre seriously and takes the plot seriously, and I kind of like that. There are science fiction movies that really don't know what to do with science fiction. They know they want to put something pretty on the wall, but they don't really know how to treat the genre with respect in order to get the best out of it.
It needs a spaceship. It needs a moon.
Yeah. It needs a chick in a bikini.
A ray gun.
Yeah.
I think one of the things I've always found with science fiction is that it's almost like science fiction and cinema are actually a relatively poor fit because science fiction is very much a genre of ideas. Rather than of characters.
Well, the first movie ever made was a science fiction film, Charcuterie Mécanique, which is about 3 minutes long, and it's a French short film where they throw a pig into the one end of a machine and sausages and hams come out the other.
Yep.
It's a science fiction movie, so I think it is a fit, but I think that you have to have a certain science fiction literacy to make it work.
Yeah.
Mm.
And a lot of people don't have that. Natalia obviously has. He does know his science fiction very well.
Yeah. What I was going to say, though, is because if science fiction is very much a genre of ideas, whereas cinema is very much a medium of images, and so Hollywood in particular is often very, very good at the images, but they're not very, very good at the ideas. And what I like about Natalie is in his science fiction films, you know, like Cube and this and Splice, he's very good at taking one really solid, interesting idea and playing with that.
Absolutely. And this one, it is identity and brainwashing and corporate manipulation and those sort of things in this film. But it goes back to something that has kind of really educated me in film, and I'm going to name drop terribly here, so I apologise up front. I once met Kevin Spacey, and I was at a press conference he did for Albino Alligator in 98, back when I was writing movie reviews for Festival and Harley Kane.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that Spacey said that was really interesting and stuck with me was, movies are an incredibly young art form. They're only 100 years old, roughly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And we still don't have the kind of vocabulary and the grammar of cinema that we have for music, that we have for plays, that we have for paintings and things like that.
Mm.
It takes time for that stuff to accrete.
And evolve.
Mm,
yeah.
And evolve. And movies are fairly new. And the fact that they do get it right some of the time is credit to them, and it proves that it's a genre that's worth having.
Yeah.
Well, it's not a genre, but an art form that's worth having because even though there's going to be shoddy things, there are always going to be paintings of dogs playing poker.
Yeah.
But then you've got the Sistine Chapel. So occasionally movies bring up a Sistine Chapel or even just an interesting little piece of art.
Mm.
Yeah, I agree.
But we're still learning how to do it, and our tools are developing as well. I mean, using computer graphics to support the story rather than be the story.
Mm.
We're still learning to do that.
And that shows that it is constantly evolving. It's just, it's constantly moving.
And the thing is, it's moving in radial directions. Mm. I mean, you can look at, there are some interesting new science fiction films coming out in French that English-speaking people don't see very much.
Yeah.
And action, even the action film genre in French, the French action films kick ass big time.
We've always had this problem. I mean, I assume it's fairly similar problem in the US, but certainly here in Australia. The French films we get are basically the ones that hit the festival circuit. So they're about a middle-aged man with his wife and his mistress, usually stars someone like Daniel Auteuil or Gerard Depardieu.
But on the other hand,
they're the only ones we get.
Mad Men Video are doing some good stuff. They're the ones who released OSS Sondi, Seb Rio, Ne Répond Plus. And the OSS 117 movies with Jean Dujardin, which are really good comedies. And
they are.
They're the best piss takes of genre films. I mean, they leave Austin Powers for dead. And one of my great pleasures is the fact that I was spruiking Jean Dujardin 5 years before he got an Oscar.
That's true. I remember you spruiking Jean Dujardin at me many years ago.
And, it is a fairly young art form. And even little bits like Cypher really show that you can do a science fiction movie done well it doesn't strain people's scientific credibility at all.
No.
Because they do keep it within a certain limitation. They don't try to... They wow you, but they don't wow you with spectacle. They wow you with ideas.
Yeah. I found with Cypher, I didn't think this up first. I read it somewhere, and I sadly can't remember where I read it. But I liked the sentiment, which was that Cypher's possibly the best adaptation of a Philip K. Dick story in cinema, even though it's not actually directly based on anything by Philip K. Dick.
It's very much influenced by it, but not in a stealing kind of way, but that same kind of worldview where reality isn't what you think it is.
Mm.
And people have multiple roles.
And also just the jacked-up paranoia as well.
Yeah. And there's that great bit where they've got a very boring meeting with PowerPoint presentations.
I was just thinking about that, yeah. Where they have the things on their heads.
Yeah, when suddenly things, people find out they're being drugged in their mineral water. Well, they don't find out. He does.
Mm.
Mm.
And there's some very, very fucked up things going on in the room while people are watching this incredibly dull presentation.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
that's awesome. That's almost kind of Cronenberg era. That's almost Videodrome kind of
thing.
So that's another one of the influences that Natalie brought into that. But he does it in his own style and his own way, which is really important.
Mm.
And I think he's definitely one of the guys to watch. He's doing an adaptation of Neuromancer. I know that's been done. They've tried to do that a number of times, but I think Natalie may have the chops to do it if he gets studio support.
I think he would as well, because one thing that I've found that he's really good at is making his ideas understandable to just, you know, I don't really mean this as it sounds, but, you know, to the layman audience, I really feel like anyone can just go and watch Cube. They can go and watch Cypher.
Yeah.
And they'll still enjoy it and still get a lot out of it.
And the nice thing is that it doesn't telegraph the turns.
No.
Well, you've got something you think, okay, what's this? This is a kind of boring corporate guy with a fucked up marriage.
Mm.
And then it'll take a sharp veer to the left.
Yeah.
And I'm gesturing right when I do that.
It's stage left.
No one would have known that unless you'd have first told them.
Yeah, no, but it's more fun if I tell them. But, yeah, that kind of thing. And the thing is, to do that, sometimes you lose the audience.
Yeah.
If you take a really weird turn in a movie, you can lose the audience. In this one, he doesn't. He takes you with him.
Yep.
And maybe it's Jeremy Northam who does that slightly mannered thing, but he is an engaging actor.
He is, yeah.
And he brings you with him.
Mm.
In the film. And Lucy Liu, people like Lucy Liu because she's cute and Asian and cute.
She does a very, very good sort of femme fatale in this film, like she drawing does. A lot of those sort of noir elements, particularly Lady the first of few mystery. Scenes.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And one of the things you should say about this movie is, and this isn't particularly a spoiler, it is a love story.
Mm.
Yeah.
And in quite an unusual way, which I really, really like about that. I think it's a really interesting choice to make. The plot hinges on a love story rather than a great big corporate thing or computers becoming intelligent or any of those other big science fiction tropes. The motivations of certain characters are very human and emotional motivations.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
Well, we did talk about that element of the film, but we both found the ending of Cypher a little bit...
It gets a little Hollywood in the last 5 minutes or so. Not unforgivably so, but it feels like it doesn't quite match the tone of the rest of the film.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the choice of location for that last bit
is
the bit that veers it into a cliche.
I'm offering more wine.
Yes, and I've got to drive when I finish this, so I'm declining very politely.
I don't, because I don't drive, and I live here.
Well, that's always a plus. If you're going to get stonked on clean skin Merlot, you might as well live
here. Well, I'm not going to get stonked anyway, you know.
I do love there's a boldness to Natalie's films that I really appreciate. I mean, I think he's getting bolder as he goes along, particularly with Splice, which...
Splice is incredibly dark in certain places, particularly towards the ending.
Oh.
And it's consistent, the tone's consistent throughout. And that dark ending really is transgressive. And I think he's Canadian, I'm not too sure, but there's a feel of Canadianness about that in the sense that Americans tend to back away from the abyss, whereas he'll just jump over there and take you with him.
Well, Splice has one of the... I don't really want to spoil it for anyone who hasn't seen it, particularly since we're not supposed to be talking about Splice, but it has one of the boldest choices I've seen in a science fiction film that I've noticed. We're basically at a particular point in the film, and anyone who's seen it knows the point.
Yeah.
it takes one of those turns that we were just talking about.
Yeah.
And I've noticed this particular turn, audiences either really go with it or really, really fail to go with it. Seems a very divisive plot point.
And you need a strong actor like Adrian Brody, who's not everyone's cup of tea.
Mm.
But you need a strong actor to take you along with that stuff as well.
Mm, yeah.
But Natalie is, I mean, you don't hear much talk about him.
No, he's very much under the radar.
Everybody just wants to see Ridley Scott do a prequel to Alien so you find out what happens to the space jockey. Whereas Natalie is somebody to really watch.
He's doing new stuff.
He's doing new stuff, and he's got an original vision.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, I'll diverge a bit and talk about Prometheus for a moment. I know the reason why Prometheus got made. Ridley Scott's last few films tanked, so he went back to a safe franchise, even though he didn't completely go back to the franchise, but they associated it with that, so he would have a success. He's a genre film director with a knighthood.
Mm.
But he makes shit choices. I mean, Russell Crowe as Robin Hood.
Oh, his Robin Hood movie is... Oh.
It's his.
Yeah, I never saw that. Is that a bad thing?
It's a what? I've said this to a couple of people, his Robin Hood movie, because I'm a big fan of Robin Hood as a bit of sort of, you know, pop culture over the centuries, and I tend to watch every Robin Hood as it comes out, and I like most of them to some degree or another. The Ridley Scott Robin Hood is actually a very engaging medieval drama.
Yeah.
And it's got some lovely details and some lovely performances, but it's absolutely appalling Robin Hood.
It is, because Robin Hood did not start his career as a 45-year-old alcoholic.
This is true.
Yeah.
He's the older. He's the oldest on-screen Robin Hood of all time.
He isn't.
I thought he pipped Connery by a couple of months.
He might have pipped him. I'm not sure, but it's bloody close. Sean Connery is bald, so that makes up for it.
He got bald real early, though, didn't he?
He did. If you have a look at him in Doctor No, there's a thinness to certain parts of his head. Now, I don't want to talk about any sensitive directions for other people around the table. Kind of wearing slight rugs and weaves and things like that in there, but Sean Connery brought it across because he's Sean Connery.
Yeah.
Mm.
And his Robin Hood was great too, because he was vulnerable and nobody had seen that in a Robin Hood before.
And he was playing an old Robin Hood. That was the whole point of the film. Yeah. Whereas the Ridley Scott version, he doesn't need to be that old. It just happens that he wanted to work with Russell Crowe again.
Yeah, which shows that it's a vanity project as much as anything. And that's one of the things. That's one of the... remember when Lucas said he was only going to make hobby films from now on?
And you questioned making before?
Yeah, I was like, well, everything after, including THX 1138, was a hobby film in a sense. You're the biggest hobby filmmaker in the world. And then after a 40-year career, you say, I'm going to go away and make hobby films. It's like Hitchcock saying, I'm going to go away now and make suspense movies.
Yeah, because I didn't get it right.
Yeah. It is sad that we don't really, as a sort of community, if you like, of film fans and lovers and critics and that whole, anyone who views films, we don't often pay attention to the Natalis because their films are smaller and they're more intimate.
Yeah.
And they lack the massive marketing juggernaut that the directors like Ridley Scott and George Lucas have the benefit of.
Absolutely. And there are two types of science fiction movie fans, in my theory. You know how when you have a baby lying in a bassinet and they have those mobiles overhead with all the pretty little things on them that make noises and stuff like that? There's some science fiction fans that are like that. They want the pretty lights and the pretty special effects and the little stuff that makes them go goo.
Mm.
And there are other ones who want to put it together the fucker out of Lego. And who really like the construction of the thing rather than the fact that it's pretty lights.
Yeah.
I mean, you've got to have a story underlying it, otherwise it's just masturbation.
That's what I think Natalia is really good at.
He is.
Like, the ideas that he comes up with. I mean, Cube is actually one of my favourite films.
I saw Cube at a preview. It was down at the Nova in Melbourne.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And they got two of the reels mixed up.
Oh,
they had like two real threes and no real four or something like that.
Uh-huh.
And so they offered people tickets and nobody could figure out where the hell did that go. He's back 10 minutes later. It was really an unfortunate.
I was just going to ask if it was like that.
I had to wait for VHS to find out the plot of Cube because they were given by the distributor the wrong reels. I mean, I was pissed off even though it was a freebie.
Well, it's the point of it.
I was wasting lifespan on that movie. I wanted to see the whole film.
That actually happened to us once. We went and saw the Ramones documentary. Yes. Was it End of the Century, Something of the Century? I can't remember the name.
can't remember. Because
there's been a couple of Ramones docos.
Yeah.
But this one, they transposed two of the reels.
Yeah.
So it was like reels 3 and 4 the wrong way around. So this sort of chronological documentary went from like 1975 to 1985, jumped to 1991, got to 1995, jumped back to 1986.
Yeah.
It's confusing. The best experience like that I had in the cinema was I went to see at the old Valhalla in Sydney, Plan 9 from Outer Space and Robot Monster. This was when VHS was only fairly new too, so people couldn't get to see the movies otherwise. Midnight Session, which is great because you get every geek in the universe turning up there. Some drunk turns up, sits dead center front row and pukes. And the janitor wasn't available. So we watched the whole movie with this great big half circle of empty seats around where the guy had puked.
It
enhanced the experience in really odd ways. You thought, yeah, well, this is definitely a cult movie showing. No one's sitting near the guy that puked.
Yeah.
Who they threw out, fortunately. The other good experience, which I've talked about on Paleo Cinema once before, you're going to like this. Giant Spider Invasion, 1975. They have a giant spider, which is actually a Volkswagen bug covered in spider. It's a really shit movie.
That's brilliant.
It's really shit movie. And it's shown in this tiny little cinema that used to be a Chinese cinema down in Pitt Street in Sydney.
Yeah.
So I go to see, because I'll see anything genre, even at that stage. So I go and see it, and the people doing it were, they just got together and started a cinema.
Yeah.
Didn't last too long. But they decided what they were going to do is halfway through the movie, get a guy in a spider suit to come out from the side of the stage and crawl down the sloping thing in front of the stage and boogie-boogie the audience. So they do it. And I'm there going, oh, great. But there's some guy who's on something sitting down the front and sees this giant fucking spider come out. And he beat the shit out of the guy. He took a pounding. And they had to get the other ushers in to get this guy off him. And he's screaming because this giant fucking spider came out of the screen and started attacking him.
Oh,
and this poor
usher
got beaten the shit out of him.
That's unreal.
But my favourite cinema experience as well. I went and saw one of the Scream movies, and halfway through it, one of the a young woman sitting in front of me blurted, "Look out!" at the screen, which is always worth it.
Yeah.
Very embarrassed.
Oh, yeah, but they do that. And, yeah, I mean, it's like people with mobile phones in cinemas. I think you should be allowed to shoot them.
Oh,
man.
Yeah. I mean, unless they're a doctor who's going to do life-saving surgery, in which case sit in a bar and drink or something, whatever you've got to do. But, people call them, yeah, I'm watching this movie. It's not very good. It's not now, you fuckwit. Yeah.
I don't actually know what's worse, mobile phones or laser pointers. I actually threatened to beat a young guy to death.
Yeah, you did.
You
got applause, remember?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, I can see you doing that. I can absolutely see you doing that.
Because, I can't even remember what film it was.
No, I can't either. It was some years ago now, back in Perth.
Yeah. It was all I could think of to do.
That's even worse than
there's only one
phones.
Place where laser pointers are good in a movie. I decided I was going to do this next time I saw a Predator movie, is get three laser pointers and then aim them in a triangle at the back of people's heads at random around the audience. I thought that would work really, really well. And
that's
Sal actually
really
brought me three
idea.
Little laser pointers.
Yeah, hell yeah.
Yeah, so yeah, did you ever three laser pointers on a Nerf gun or something? You aim the triangle of dots at the back of their head and shoot them in the back of their head with a Nerf dart.
Oh, I'm keeping that in mind if that's all right.
I think, no, please use it. I think it's a perfect thing for a Predator movie because some of them are very good and you need some kind of diversion. We're drifting again, which is always fine.
Yeah.
One thing I was going to say about, it feels like about 4 hours
ago. I just came out and, said that I gave death threats to some random person in a cinema. So, talk about whatever you like.
Yeah. One of the things I do really like visually about Natali's films, and it's very clearly a side effect of the comparatively low budgets. Like, from memory, I think Cypher was about a $6 million movie.
It was.
Drawing that off the top of my head, though.
Yeah.
Is that he never, ever shoots a shot that isn't necessary.
No.
Yeah.
He doesn't even bother with establishing shots. Other directors will show you this is the building, and then you see inside the building. He doesn't even bother with that, particularly in this film. So you just go from a set of interiors, and it cuts to another set of interiors.
Mm. But it's always understandable.
It is understandable,
but it
makes it so oppressive.
Mm.
And it gives it more of a sense of reality because reality doesn't have establishing shots.
Yeah.
No, you don't
and
go and look outside
having,
something
and
before you go
it gives
you
it a slightly
there.
More documentary look, even though it's not a documentary by any means.
Yeah.
It does away with that convention because, I mean, I've seen establishing shots work where they're funny or something like that, but they're really a hangover from TV.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Establishing shots are mostly a TV thing, so you know whose house you're in when they're talking in the kitchen about how the husband's got his toe stuck in the drain or whatever comedy trope they're doing that episode. And movies have taken that on because a lot of directors moved on from TV to movies. And it was also done for things like the live dramas in the 50s, where you had to, if you were doing, say, Frankenstein, you needed to show the outside of the castle before the interior.
Well, also in live television, or even in, like, for example, in the UK, they were still recording things as live in the 60s, is you needed those establishing shots to give the cast time to physically walk from one set in the soundstage to another to start the next scene.
But yeah, it's hung over into movies.
Yeah.
But it also feels like a thing to differentiate film from theatre, because you can't do establishing shots in theatre.
Mm.
So, you know, they do establishing shots in film because, well, we're different to theatre. So,
no, I suppose you could, because there are those kind of semi-transparent curtains where you could project an establishing shot in theatre if you chose to.
Yeah.
But it looks silly.
Well, yeah, that's the thing, I think. Yeah. Mm.
But, I do like this film. I like the corporate espionage side of it, where they've taken it slightly into the future with ruthless corporations. I mean, of course, it was before the global crash. So the corporations weren't looked upon at that stage quite with the cynicism we look upon them with now.
But you watch the film now and it seems really quite like...
I could see those bastards doing that,
yeah.
One of the things I particularly like is I don't remember ever finding out what these corporations actually do.
Yep, and what they want.
There's two corporations furiously trying to get, you know, espionage and secret information out of each other. But you never actually find out what their main product is or service.
The information that they want.
It's kind of like the spy versus spy comics in Mad magazines.
Yeah.
they're at each other's throats because they're at each other's throats.
Yeah.
And yeah, some people are working for both of them, which is obviously a nice earner because you get two pay packets. and there's triple crosses and double crosses and people who are in there but aren't part of the thing, like Morgan Sullivan proves to be.
I worry this film's kind of slipping between the cracks, because everyone remembers Cube because it was very low budget, got a lot of publicity when it came out, very kind of iconic film. And Splice got quite a lot of attention. But it almost feels like Cypher's starting to slip through the cracks.
I think what it feels like is he had the success with Cube, he wanted to do something different. And he chose this because it does have it's not a one-room drama in the sense that Cube was.
Yeah.
And he wanted to have those wide vistas. He wanted to play with the technology as well and use it to tell the story. The bit where they walk out into the field and there's suddenly an enormous elevator. Okay, just to summarise, guys, Cypher. Would you recommend it? Wouldn't you recommend it? We don't do scores here, but...
Oh, absolutely would recommend it.
I would, yeah, definitely.
It's not expensive to get either. It's fairly cheap to get on DVD if you can find it. I don't think there's a Blu-ray release, but it's not hard to find.
No.
But then what is these days?
No. The wonder of the internet.
And also, if you did like Splice and you want to follow Natalie's career, you've got to see it, because it's kind of halfway between the Cube era and Splice and Black Death and the Neuromancer adaptation that I do hope he does.
He's also got a very low-budget, weird comedy called Nothing in the middle there.
Oh, Nothing is an interesting film, too, where the two guys in the house... decide that they can find out how to make things disappear, and they take it to incredibly silly extremes. Yeah, so if you want to see Nothing, you should see Nothing. It was on Foxtel for a while, but I don't think that'd be a hard thing to search for in a search engine. You type Nothing and what do you get?
Your screen just goes blank.
Yeah, well, that's it.
But yeah, Cypher, definitely recommend
it. Yeah, absolutely. And Vincenzo Natali, definitely a director to watch. And we're going to take another break now. When we get back, we're going to talk about Jerome Bixby's The Man from Earth.
What if a man from the upper Paleolithic survived until the present day?
You know what could happen? Yeah, the pancreas turns over cells every 24 hours, the stomach lining, in 3 days, the entire body. In 7 years, but the process falters. Now, if a quirk in his immune system led to perfect detox, perfect renewal, then yeah, he could duck decay.
We were just talking about a caveman who survives until the present time.
And he hasn't aged a day in 10 years. Every woman on the faculty would give anything to have that secret.
Ah! Jeez!
I don't have eyes in the back of my head. I can't hear a flea walking. I am not in any way Superman.
There have always been legends of such a thing, a creature
not quite human, taking not the blood, but the life force itself?
God has spoken through man to make his word clearer.
You got four men of science completely baffled, my friend. Who do you think I am?
You are absolutely certifiable.
You stand alive and tall in a graveyard that you helped to fill? Well, then perhaps it is time to die.
And we're back again after hiatus talking about cats' asses and guys who tease monkeys.
And we're going
We actually did. I'm not exaggerating at all. And we're going to talk about the 2007 movie called The Man from Earth, also known as Jerome Bixby's Man from Earth. You might know Jerome Bixby because he did some episodes of Star Trek and he was known as a science fiction author. And in a sec, I'm going to get Grant to read out the synopsis one more once.
Okay, well, the plot of The Man from Earth focuses on John Oldman, who's a departing university professor, who basically his fellow colleagues come to his house on the day that he's leaving, and sort of unofficial farewell party, during which he basically claims that he's a Cro-Magnon man who's somehow survived for 14,000 years.
That's pretty much it, and there are a few nice twists and turns. I don't know whether you guys found them nice, but I kind of liked the twists and turns, and I think there's a nice bit of ensemble acting in this one as well.
I don't know where to start with this one.
Start with who's in it.
Start with who's in it.
Candyman.
Yeah, Tony Todd Candyman.
It's got a very culty fan cast. So yeah, so John Oldman, the professor who claims to be Cro-Magnon, played by David Lee Smith. It's also got Tony Todd, John Billingsley, who sci-fi fans will probably know from the Star Trek show that no one watched, Enterprise.
Yeah, Enterprise, yeah.
Ellen Crawford, who...
A good jobbing actor.
Is Ellen Crawford the one she's who was in one, Boomtown?
Yeah, she was. Your favourite show. She's the talented one. She's from Boomtown.
Did you ever see Boomtown?
No.
It's amazing. One single season. Oh, no, ran for one season and then six episodes.
Yeah.
But it was a cop drama produced in America where it followed the police, the paramedics, the lawyers,
detectives,
the criminals. Yep. So basically, I had like six strands in each episode.
The victims.
Yep.
And it was completely non-linear. So it would show you a bit of the story and then fill it on. So she was in that. Also, William Catt, who is best known
Greatest
for...
American Hero.
Greatest American Hero. And I'm sure there's someone else. Oh, yeah. Annika Pearson.
Mm-hmm.
Richard Reilly.
Yep. People will recognise by his face, if nothing else. He's a kind of portly character actor of a certain age.
Mm. Alexis Thorpe. Oh, it's Ellen Crawford. Yeah, Ellen Crawford's the one who I know because she's in about 10 seasons of ER as one of the nurses.
Okay. I'm glad I missed that one. But anyway, yeah, so basically, tell me what you thought about it, and I'm sorry if you didn't like it.
Did you want to start? Or?
It's very stagey, isn't it?
Yeah.
Very stagey.
Yeah. And it was done as a play later on.
I read that, yeah. I can see it working better as a play than as a film, to be
honest.
Well,
we talked about that, didn't we?
Yeah.
One of the main things this film felt like to me was it felt like a drunk conversation without the humour. You know, when you get together with some of your friends and when you get really, really pissed, you start saying, oh, you know, what if I was the oldest person alive? Oh, what if I was a caveman? You know, what if? That's what it felt like to me.
Yeah, but on the other hand, because it felt like that, it means the ensemble worked in the piece.
It's funny. I mean, the main reaction I took away from this initially is that this film is cheap.
It is a $200,000 budget.
And I was surprised when you told me it was $200,000 because that actually sounds like a bit much for what you see on screen.
I think, you know, they had to get characters with a certain name, so you've got to pay them $20,000-$30,000 a pop.
Yeah, I suspect most of it's gone on the cast.
Yeah, and I think there's some good acting in the film, even if it's, yeah, there are other problems functionally with it.
And it's a very frustrating film, I suppose, because if someone was to ask me, did I like the film, I pretty much didn't. I thought it was a fairly poorly made film, poorly shot, looks cheap. I didn't like a lot of the acting.
Yeah.
The idea at the core of it, however, is a really interesting idea, and the fact that it is basically a 90-minute conversation where a bunch of intelligent people discuss what it would be like for someone to live for 14,000 years.
Yeah, and that's what I took from the film. That's a bit I liked. Yeah, I think with a larger budget and maybe different actors and a couple more goes around on the script,
yeah,
it could have been a lot better. But basically, this is a kind of thought piece.
Very much. It almost felt like the Jerome Bixby, the writer, had... It was almost like working through the ideas himself. And I would almost prefer to see the film that got made once they'd worked out those ideas. Like, not necessarily that conversation.
Yeah, it's like the film was him thinking out loud.
Yeah. Well, it was finished posthumously. The script was finished posthumously by his son.
Oh, okay.
And he kind of narrated it as he was dying. So obviously it's a very important consideration if you're dying to think about immortality.
Mm.
So I think it may have been his kind of ruminations and speculations about immortality, which makes it...
And you see, that's completely believable.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally.
And there are some nice twists in the plot where, which work well as a play, as pivot points for a play.
Yeah.
Mm.
Where you find out some of the things he did and some of the things he was in earlier life, if you believe him. And there is a point at the end which gives credence to what he says.
But nothing that he said is anything that you couldn't look up yourself.
That's the problem. That's one of the things in the film is, you know, people say that in the film.
Yeah, Tony Todd's character.
Yeah,
Tony Todd's
character.
It was really good. He reminded me a lot in this film. It's the most nuanced and intelligent thing I've seen Tony Todd do. It reminded me a lot of Delroy Lindo.
I actually thought it was Delroy Lindo at the first
time. Yeah, I remember you saying that.
And, you know, I think what it might have been too is that I don't know whether how tight the script was written, but it does feel like a piece where the actors had a lot of input to it.
Mm.
Mm.
Tony Todd's an actor I've always liked because he's one of those very solid B-grade actors. You know, he's in the Reliable, Final Destination films. He's in Candyman. He was in a whole pile of Star Trek.
Yeah.
And he's not necessarily the greatest actor in the world, but he's always solid.
Mm. Yeah, he is.
He's in The Rock. Yeah, he's solid. He's reliable. Got
credibility.
Yeah.
Which is the thing. And William Catt, I mean, obviously, from what I understand, he has had some problems with various things in the past, and he does look a lot older in this film. I think he's okay, but it's very much a minor role.
The one who actually really irritated both of us when we were watching is John Billingsley.
I agree.
The funny one, in quotation
marks. Yeah, the funny nerd. I think he's out of step with the rest of the acting in this film. Yeah. I think he's a little broad.
Yeah, it felt very much like community theatre, which is not to and that's not to criticise community theatre because we've both done quite a lot of community theatre, but there is a certain style of acting that inexperienced amateurs do.
Yeah, and
which he's doing, which I haven't seen him do in other things that he's been in.
Yeah, I don't know whether it was a bad time for him. Occasionally, I've seen good actors do bad work because of their life around the work.
Mm.
I don't know whether that's the case in this one, but I think he is the off-key element in this. But I think the protagonist, the main character...
David Lee Smith,
is very credible and very kind of charismatic.
He gives really, really nice... It's one of those... a very subtle performance that he actually leaves enough space that, as a viewer, you can kind of fill in the emotion, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Like, really solid screen acting.
And he does bring that kind of very right reluctance... Of the character to talk about certain things because you get an idea when he brings it up that he knows where it's going to lead if he lets it go on, and it leads to a place that makes a lot of the other people very uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Mm.
But I like the film because I like the ideas in it, and I think that there are science fiction films that have not a lot of ideas in them, and there are movies like this that have too many ideas for what they're trying to hold, and the object they're putting them in isn't the right shape for them.
Mm.
I do have one big criticism I have of the exploration of him being 14,000 years old. Yeah. On the most part, I actually really liked it, and that is what sustained my interest pretty much to the end of the film, because I did find it quite a struggle in the first 20 minutes.
It is, it's a slow burn,
Oh yeah, the acting was annoying me. The direction was annoying me. I was obvious that after about 20 minutes that it is going to be entirely set in the one house with a sort of a prolonged conversation.
Which makes it very stagey,
But the concept kept dragging me in despite all of that until, to be honest, for the last 24 hours, I really haven't thought of much other than this film. It keeps dwelling in my mind, which I suppose makes it...
It's a meme.
Yeah, very recommendable.
Yeah.
It's an earworm.
But the thing that really annoyed me, because it's just one of those tiny, really grating things, is that it falls into that trap where, because he's lived for centuries and centuries and centuries, he's met a whole pile of famous historical figures. Yeah. And I hate when they do that.
Yeah, what a lucky guy.
And it hits a crisis point, if you like. There's basically the one major key twist scene towards the end of the film, which I don't want to spoil, but it was very bold, but I actually found it was possibly the most obvious direction I could have gone in.
Yeah, in a sense, but I think it could have been handled, yeah, the steering of the plot towards that could have been handled a lot better.
Yeah.
And it would have worked. You got to build up to it. But on the other hand, there weren't that many famous people he really saw. He did meet Van Gogh.
Yeah, and Columbus was another one that we mentioned.
And Columbus, which you've got to admit, there's not that many people over a 40,000-year span of history. I mean, if you're bumping around a world where there's only like 50 or 60 million people on the planet at the time,
yeah,
you're going to bump into somebody who does something sooner or later. And I think that they might have chosen better in who they did choose. But I do kind of like the revelation because it's consistent with what I know about the world.
Yeah.
Even though I think they could have got to it in, I'm not necessarily subtler, but in a more nuanced kind of way.
They're very bold ideas, which I do appreciate.
Mm.
Yeah, and they're painted broadly. But I do like a small movie with ideas, even if it's done cack-handedly. I do like the ideas in it, and I do like the acting that carries the ideas. But there's something wrong with the structure.
Mm.
Yeah, well, with structure, I had a problem with the fact that the characters really weren't introduced that well. I didn't really give a shit about anyone.
Yeah.
Well, they're all pretty much introduced at once, with the exception of the psychiatrist figure who comes in halfway through.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Dr. Gruber.
But I didn't even care about him. They're just not... not written into the story. Yeah.
Because the story isn't about them, they're just there to carry
That's very obvious.
Yeah.
But if you're going to watch a film that is just based in the one room and it's just about conversations with them, and, you know, a conversation isn't just a lecture, it's conversation, yeah, they're taking part in it.
Mm.
I cared about what the main guy was saying. I didn't care about their answers.
It's almost, it felt a little bit...
So I didn't care about the conversation.
Yeah. I see your point. But for me, it felt a little bit like they were quizzing him or they were interrogating him about what he was saying.
Mm.
So in that sense, they were reflections of what he had said, and they're the arguments against what he said, or they're asking for clarification. So in a sense, it's a star piece and everybody else is secondary, with a couple of exceptions, particularly towards the end. There's one of the minor characters who becomes quite important in the revelation.
Yeah.
Mm.
But I think that... it's a hard one to do well in that kind of a setting. I don't know where else you would set it.
Yeah.
To make it work. But I think that if they had have had more time to work it, to work the script,
yeah,
and maybe a bit more money to have more options.
It did seem a bit rushed.
Yeah.
I suspect it was just from being a low-budget film. It was probably shot over about a week, wouldn't
it? Yeah, but did have a short shooting time. Yeah. I did read that.
Okay.
And but I do like... with the exception of John Billingsley, I do like the ensemble. I do think they gave us a feel that they'd known each other for years, which is quite an important aspect of the film. Everybody had known each other for at least 10 years. A lot of them did sound like academics.
Yeah,
which is hard to get with actors, because actors aren't necessarily very educated people. They've been trying to get roles since they were 15. In a lot of cases, they didn't have time to get a proper education in a lot of cases.
Mm.
But in this... I think that there are admirable qualities to this film, but there's a problem with that structure. I think that it's a great ideas movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is.
And I think as a play, people would watch it and enjoy it.
I would be very interested to see it as a play.
I think it'd work brilliantly as a play, because if you're watching a play, if you're in the theatre and you've kind of got no choice but to watch the people in the room.
Also, your patience, the patience in a theatre audience is much greater than the patience for a film audience. Yeah, exactly.
And also, if you're watching it on TV the way I did,
yeah,
there are distractions. And a movie where you've got to follow the thread of this one, and where there are thin parts of that thread, distraction can come in.
Yeah.
Yeah. Be
careful. And that's one of the things about watching things at home compared to watching it in a cinema. Cinema's a captive audience at home. You can go and take a piss and take a break from it and go and do some grocery shopping and come back again and feed the cat and do all the rest of it.
And you're like, should I pause it? Should I not pause it? Mm.
This movie, to get the most out of it, it does have to have all of your attention.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I totally agree with the flaws you guys seen it. I saw them myself to some extent. But I love the ideas, and I love idea cinema.
It is... I find it very frustrating because, yeah, I still feel technically it's a very bad film in the way it's, particularly in the way it's directed. I think the direction of the film is actually fairly bad.
Young guy, yeah. And you're fairly new director, yeah. But he wanted to, I think he did an ambitious project, given the budget, given one of the actors he had working for it, given that he was fairly new and obviously wouldn't have had a large choice of actors. Mm. Some people would budget themselves out of being in the movie.
The ideas are, as you say, that they're fantastic.
Yeah, the ideas are brilliant.
And that's one of the reasons why I wanted to do, one of the things I wanted to do with the podcast is the odd quirky things that aren't necessarily perfect, but that are interesting. And this is a perfect Martian drive-in movie for what I wanted to do with the podcast in that it's interesting, though very flawed.
Mm.
Yeah.
So I really wanted, that's why I wanted to introduce it to you guys, because I knew you'd run with it one way or the other.
Mm.
I'm glad we saw it.
Yeah, so am I.
For me, I've seen it 3 times now.
Yeah.
And I pick up new little bits each time I watch it, just little subtle bits of acting. And the acting doesn't draw attention to itself, but because you're doing it for a podcast or something, you've got that extra focus.
Mm.
And particularly in the main character, there are some lovely subtle bits of acting there. And just little bits of business,
yeah.
That
I think he did lend really credence well, yeah.
to the story, and he's very good at that.
It's a very hard thing to sell, to say I'm a 14,000-year-old caveman,
yeah.
to your friends, and he sells it. And that is one of the things in the script that actually did impress me is that you've got 90 minutes to believably get a set of characters to go from confusion over this guy's claims to entertaining it as a party game to getting genuinely disturbed that he may be mentally unwell, to some of them potentially actually believing that he's a 14,000-year-old man.
Mm. And
they sell that.
It starts out differently. They're wondering why their friend is leaving after 10 years.
Mm.
And he moves on every 10 years because he says, and ultimately there's a revelation that assists us in believing that.
Mm.
That way people don't see that he doesn't age.
Mm.
And that's an incredibly believable part of that. You've got to move on. I don't know what kind of connections he's got in getting IDs and things, but I can see in the future being increasingly hard to be who he is.
Mm.
Yeah.
And I think he's got the little bits of the movie give me a sense of that foreboding of for the future and how is he going to be invisible. If he is indeed a 14,000-year-old man, how is he going to remain invisible with ubiquitous surveillance?
Mm.
Well, he mentions his fear of, you know, just going in and getting some quick blood tests to prove his claims because he's worried if he goes into a lab, he'll never leave.
Yeah. And that's a perfectly reasonable fear if he is what he says he is. Mm. And it's something that anybody who's unusual at all to that extent, I mean, if you were a superhero, the first thing you'd do is leave and become invisible because people would cut you apart to find out why you got superpowers.
Mm. Yeah.
Which is one of the problems I've got with superhero movies to a certain extent, is in a real world context, they're lab rats.
Yeah. Also the fact that they go around fighting, you know, two-bit hoods and don't go around solving, you know, hunger in sub-Saharan Africa.
If I was Iron Man, the first thing I'd do for PR is I'd get all those corpses off Mount Everest. Because there are about 200 of them at the moment.
Yeah.
Mm.
But, but this guy, interesting. Let's summarise, because we're getting into the point where we'll probably summarise. There's not too much more to say unless we'd go deep into spoilers.
Mm.
But to summarise, a really interesting ideas movie, even if it's unsuccessful in certain aspects.
Yeah.
Would
you guys say that?
Yeah.
I was actually thinking it would make a really interesting double bill with Highlander, the original Russell Mulcahy film.
Yeah.
Because both of them deal with
longevity.
Longevity. Yeah. One of them is, this one is very, it's got brilliant ideas and really, really explores the concept in a very realistic, interesting way.
Mm-hmm.
But the production values are essentially non-existent. It's very flatly directed. Yeah. And by contrast, Highlander, which is dumb as a bag of hammers, but has incredibly tight visuals by Russell Mulcahy. And, the Rocking Queen soundtrack, and it's a very, very hyper-slick 80s film. So you kind of get the two opposite ends of the same concept.
Yeah, but that's an interesting thing, too. A movie like Highlander is dated incredibly, which is why people are talking about doing a remake now. It's like, Lady Hawk.
Yeah.
With the kind of synth soundtrack.
Oh, Tangerine Dream soundtrack.
Dream soundtrack. Which took me out of the movie when I first saw it in the 80s.
Yeah.
Because the last thing you want is a synth soundtrack, Tangerine Dream.
Yeah.
And it just fucked the movie for me. Yeah. It wasn't that good a film, but it took you out of it enough that it was
intolerable. It is a very inappropriate score.
Mm-hmm.
It is. But, yeah, this film, as I said, perfect Martian drive-in movie in the sense that it's an interesting failure not many people know about.
Mm.
And that's pretty much what I want to do with it. So any final things you guys want to say about anything?
Not that I can think of just off the cuff.
Just that I'd rate, I mean, just with the last thought on Man from Earth, is it's not a film I would say is good.
Mm.
But it's definitely a film I think I'd wind up recommending. I've been thinking about this all day.
There's got to be a new word for those kind of films, doesn't there?
Well, one of the things is, I mean, we went into this film completely blind. We hadn't heard of it. No. We got the copy from you. We watched it completely blind.
Yeah.
And as a result, with no expectations, I was immediately sort of thrown out by the production values from the start. Whereas I think if someone listens to this podcast and then goes and finds it. And this is an interesting film because the producers have been actively encouraging people to download it and BitTorrent it and share it online because they want the word to get out there that the film exists.
Well, it's quite interesting because since I've watched the film, I've actually wanted to go back and watch it again because now that I know of all the bits that I didn't like, I know to look past that.
Yeah. It's a bit like having a really good story with shit sets.
Yes.
And also the set gets increasingly worse as the guys come in to take out the furniture he's giving away to charity.
Mm.
Yeah.
Which makes for an incredibly sparse mountain cabin with a fireplace and a chair or two and a bunch of people throwing ideas at each other.
Mm. Yeah.
Which for me would be a fun night. Which tonight indeed is.
Mm.
I'm really think that I've tapped into something with wanting to do this sort of movie in the podcast.
Yeah.
In the sense that a lot of movies get a lot of love, but these movies that are interesting and full of ideas but not too well done.
Yeah, and they're too easily slip between the cracks.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're so much blasted at us that some interesting projects get stuck between the cracks. But anyway, Grant and Sonia, thank you very much for being on Martian Drive-In Podcast. I will get you guys back if you want to.
That sounds really cool.
I think.
And thank you for having us.
Anytime at all. And this is the kind of conversation I wanted to have in it for a while. Cool. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, cool. That was a show that I recorded with Grant and Sonia about 3 weeks ago now, and I really did enjoy myself doing that. I'm going to take a little bit of a break with a music bit now and then come back with the feedback.
Well, all right, Star Child, citizens of the universe, recording angels, we have returned to claim the pyramid, partying on the mothership. I am the mothership connection, getting down in 3D, light year groove. Well, all right, you hear the noise, ain't nobody but me and the boy, get down. Put a glide in your stride and a dip in your hip and come on to the mothership. Loose boot, doing the bump. Hustle on over here.
That was a bit of Parliament with Mothership Connection, a little bit of funk happening here. The feedback I got blew me away. Not for any reason of volume. That really wasn't the issue. The fact that I did get some artwork for the podcast, and I really do appreciate that. The first piece I got was from Richard Palmer in Maryland. He did me a banner for the podcast. So if you go to marsdrivein.blogspot.com, you're going to see Richard's banner. It's got an alien with tentacles eating popcorn on it. It's in the right colour scheme for the podcast, which is perfect, and I really do appreciate it. I've sent Richard an email about that, and I apologise to him for getting to him late because with the way my inbox is with my emails, I've got 40,000 things in the inbox, but I searched through them, and it really did get lost in the mix, and I do apologise for that. I think it was in the spam filter for some reason. So anyway, check that out. It's really good. Also, I did get another piece of artwork, a logo for the podcast, from a guy called Gadi, and I hope I'm pronouncing that right, Gadi, who lives in Beirut in Lebanon. So I'm covering the waterfront here with the listenership, and I really groove on that too. I really appreciate that. And Gadi did me a very kind of cool sketch of an alien in the flying saucer beaming down the words of the Martian Driving podcast. You can check that out on the website as well. Both bits of art are totally different and totally in tune with what I'm trying to do with the podcast. And I think that's a good thing, and that's a very important thing. So I really appreciate both of those. If anybody else wants to contribute anything like that, I'm always happy to do it. I'm not sure whether I can continue to offer DVDs and things, but if anybody wants to contribute anything like that, it's always appreciated. We do this for the love of doing it, and that getting that kind of somebody else contributing to it in a kind of non-verbal way is something that I really treasure. But we also did get some other feedback. Let me have a look here. I did get a few things on Facebook, a few Facebook messages as well, which is always a groovy thing. Let's see what I've got there. But I did get something also in the form of a voicemail from a friend from Paleo Cinema, the inevitable and inimitable and in everything else, Dr. Zom.
Yo, 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 Terry Frost. This is Dr. Zom. I just want to give you a shout-out. I haven't not been. I guess it's because it's summer and it's really hot over here. And which, you know, you would think because it's really hot outside, I'd be inside, you know, and not out in all this oppressive heat from the global warming and all that stuff. But basically what I'm doing is not watching as many movies as what I usually been watching. But I did, you know, because we got some Martian driving, I got to ditch this. That's not working at all. It's just not working. Martian driving. Well, I watched the movie, and guess what? It takes place on Mars. And I know you're a big sci-fi fan. You are a big sci-fi fan. Big. It's called John Carter. This movie it seemed to get a lot of shit for as much as it cost, and it didn't really do that well at the box office. I have some theories on that. One being the name of the movie. If you're not familiar with the stories or the comic books, or you know the books, this comic book and everything. You know, just the name John Carter is kind of like flat, and you might not know what the hell it's about. But I liked it. I really did. I think that they, you know, it's about 2 hours long. They took their time to tell the story and tell it, you know, pretty much give you enough. I mean, it took enough time to give you the whole story. But it was action-packed and a raucous adventure. I really enjoyed it, and I think that word of mouth, hopefully, crossing my fingers and toes, will carry over with this, and maybe we'll get to see some more. It seems to me it's almost like a Firefly kind of a thing, where most of the people that I know that went to see it really liked it. It's a Disney movie, and thinking about it after the fact, I think that, you know, it's the kind of movie that you could take, you know, younger kids to go see. It does have violence in it, but like blood and stuff like that's usually green or, you know, blue or something, you know. But anyway, I really liked it. This is, you know, the Martian drive-in, you know, slash Paleo Cinema, slash, I don't know, Guns N' Roses. Anyway, John Carter, I imagine that you have seen it because you are a vociferous consumer of science fiction. But if you have any comments about John Carter, I never read the actual pulp books. I read the comic books, and it was known as John Carter, Warlord of Mars. think something like that might have helped as far as the title goes. But we'll see, you know, maybe it was because he wasn't quite the Warlord of Mars yet. Anyway, I just want to come and say, hi, Steve Gay. I just woke up. And hope everything is well in the country that you live in. Is it Japan? I don't know. Whatever that place is. Say hello to the old, hey, say hello to the old lady and, you know, the cats and stuff, okay? Say hello. All right, Mr. Frost, I just want to give you a shout. Talk to you later, brother.
Well, konnichiwa, Som. No, actually, it's Australia, not Japan. But yeah, John Carter, I enjoy John Carter. I think that it's an interesting phenomenon, the fact that it didn't do so well. There's probably a few reasons why, one of which is the source material is 100 years old, and the audience for it, people my age and older, and maybe down as young as Zom's age, who saw the comic books with the great Gil Kane artwork. But yeah, I think it's... I've got the Blu-ray myself, and I've got the Blu-ray with the additional DVD attached to it and all that sort of thing. But yeah, it's a shame that it didn't do better. I think that it's, you created a wonderful world. I think that it's different than other action films of its time. And I think it deserves a little bit more love than it really got. Other people disagree, but yeah, fuck them. But thanks for that, Zom. Thanks for coming across to the new podcast with your ineffable wonderfulness. And I know that science fiction is not your biggest genre, but if you want to drop in now and then, there's always an espresso and a chair for you here on the podcast. But that's about it this time around. As I said, I'm feeling the love for the new podcast. We also have a new podcast feed. So if you go to martiandrivein.podbean.com/feed, that's the URL for you to drop into iTunes or whatever podcatcher you have to get the podcast happening there. I did spring out the extra money to get a separate feed, but for this time I'm going to include it in the Paleo Cinema feed as well as in the new Martian Drive-In feed. But after that, I'm going to mention this in the next Paleo Cinema as well, after that Martian Drive-In podcast stands alone and gets just attached to its own feed. So if people want to listen to it, and I do sincerely hope that everybody does, even though not everybody does, I will be very happy to direct anybody who asks in the direction of the new feed. But that's about it. And thanks again to Grant and Sonia and Zom and Gardy and Richard and everybody else who's sent love about the podcast. I'm starting a new venture like this, even if you do have about a 5-year history now of podcasting, really is an act of faith. And my faith has been restored by the audience that I'm getting for it. So thank you for very much for that. And I'll be back in 4 weeks with another Martian Drive-In podcast. I've already got a guest lined up. I've already got the movies lined up, but I'm not going to spoil that. And in another 2 weeks with the next Paleo Cinema podcast, where I have a guest, and that will be Morris from Love That Album podcast. We're going to talk about a couple of old films. But anyway, take care of yourselves. Avoid the Olympics if you don't like it, because I'm doing that at the moment. Fuck the Olympics. Can't stand it. It ruins the place for the natives who live in the area, and I just don't see the point. But anyway, take care of yourselves, and I'll see you again very soon.